The next presentation covers noise, transportation, and power. These studies were conducted by consultants that have retired from their careers. And these sections or chapters of the environmental baseline document were completed quite some time ago. And so they that's part of why the consultants are no longer among us for presenting, is that they were completed a couple of years ago. And what we've done is we've gone to HDR and looked for resources there to help us with this. And so that the information will be presented by Chuck Hookham. But for background, the noise chapter of our environmental baseline document was completed by Michael Miner, and the transportation and power was done by Kevin Waring, both who have retired. So Chuck is new to the Pebble Project, and he reviewed these chapters and put together a presentation for today. Chuck Hookham has a Bachelor of Science and Postgraduate Studies in Civil Engineering from the University of Illinois. He has a Master's of Business Administration in Finance from Eastern Michigan University, and has done postgraduate study in power conversion, combustion, and renewable energy systems. He's a registered professional engineer in three states, plus holds NCEES certification. He's a voting member of multiple national technical committees in power generation. He has over 30 years of experience, primarily in the power, mining, and petroleum and gas industries, involved with project development, strategic analysis, site development and permitting, engineering design, and EPC delivery of domestic and international projects. Chuck serves as both project manager and director of projects for HDR. His recent focus has been on strategic opportunity assessments, owner's engineering services, environmental permitting, regulatory filings and economic and technical analyses, as well as risk analyses and new facility siting studies. He has been active in identifying and developing teaming opportunities with equipment manufacturers, contractors, and developers. He currently is managing the engineering of several large wind farms, grid-connected solar PV arrays, biomass gasification, and multiple natural gas fire generation station projects. Chuck was formerly employed with both Bechtel Power Corporation and Black & Veatch. While with Black & Veatch, he served as associate vice president and was responsible for project management of large generating stations, natural gas pipelines, tar sands mining and upgrading, and government, U.S. Department of Energy, and Army Corps projects. So let's welcome Chuck as he presents our environmental baseline document information on noise, transportation, and power.
First of all, thank you, Jane, for having me, and thank you, Charlotte McKay, with your group for doing some fabulous editing on my slides. Without that help, it would be not possible. I also want to acknowledge Sean Florio from HDR Anchorage, who's our principal engineer responsible for a lot of the environmental work we've been doing up here for this particular project. As part of the introduction, Jane mentioned that my predecessors have both retired and gone on. I think that's my goal. So with that, I'm just going to say, if they could do it, I can do it. So that's the next step anyway. As a result, this is probably the first time I presented a paper where I didn't actually write it. So bear with me. Hold your tomatoes for later. Don't kill the messenger, and all those kind of rules apply. This is just kind of an overview of the presentation, what we put together in terms of the two different study areas, Cook Inlet Mine Study, and then obviously the transportation corridor comes into play. And this just kind of talks a little bit about the program going forward. The objectives obviously are to characterize the baseline. And so there was work done at both Cook Inlet and mine areas, as well as transportation study area regarding baseline noise. What's there presently at the time now? How does that relate to the current backgrounds elsewhere in Alaska? What does that mean in terms of the future? That needed to be baseline characterized. transportation. Obviously, there's limited amount of transportation in these areas, but we needed to map them, understand them, look at them as far as path going forward. And then lastly, in terms of power, power generation, power transmission, anytime we're looking at a mine development, power generation is pretty critical. Having a reliable source of energy and power are particularly crucial. And in Southwest Alaska, the backbone that's there is not substantial. So we looked at that in a fair amount of detail. Basically, let me go back here a slide. So in 2006, 2008, Mike Miner was the gentleman who was involved in the noise studies. He characterized the sites two different ways. He did a fair amount of short-term and long-term noise evaluations. He focused, because the mine site does not have any development near it, and the Cook Inlet sites in the area of Iliamna Bay don't have any permanent settlements, those two areas were typically not scrutinized. The area that was measured in more detail was the transportation route between the two. Along the northern northeast shore of Iliamna Lake, there's a number of communities that are present. We wanted to characterize the background noise in those facilities, so Mike picked out locations there, and that was the basis for his study. He then characterized that amount of data that he collected and compared it against cross-sectional data across all of Alaska where he had background data available. In terms of the transportation work that was done, it was basically 2006, 2008. There's a little bit of work that was done in 2009 to characterize the transportation routes that exist. Air, water, and overland routes were looked at. Most of it was done based on previous studies, mostly based on state of Alaska work that had been done. In terms of power, Kevin Waring and Associates looked at what the infrastructure was in existing regions. Obviously, Cook Inlet not being developed, there's no real backbone, there's no power generation permanently installed in that region. Same at the mine site. So they looked carefully at what existed in terms of the transportation corridor area, the Iliamna Lake area. And then characterized also the primary source of energy in the region, which is local diesel-based fuel and its supply and local generation, and how crucial that is in terms of its current condition and what alternatives might be existing out there. Continuing on, there's a couple key points here. As I mentioned, the Cook Inlet mine studies are very remote, limited occupancy, so there's a limited amount of background data available on these topics. The mine study area is currently accessed by a number of investigators, but again, no real infrastructure was found in that area relative to these particular topics. The Cook Inlet study area really is accessible only by water at the current time. No place for simple landing of helicopters, although I trust that's been done, but it's certainly not viewed to be a viable transportation path going forward. As a result, there's really not a lot of continuous background noise in these facilities because simply there's just not a lot of operations or residency in the regions. And then there's no regional power generation or transmission systems. There is locally, Tasimina Hydro is a project HDR was involved in. It's in the Iliamna New Halen area. It helps in terms of dispatching power in that particular community and displacing some of the diesel fuel-based power in the past. And it's certainly been proven successful as far as reducing rates and adding an element of reliability and redundancy in the area. So there's really no regional power generation available. The methodologies that were used in the environmental baseline activities to date was effectively documenting whatever existed on these communities and areas physically from a desktop field inspection perspective. Neither the Cook Inlet, again, or mine study areas are located near any human development, so very sparse populations that do exist or in the community near Lake Iliamna. However, in 2004, there was a Southwest Alaska Transportation Plan that recommended the upgrade of the existing road, and we've heard about that from a couple speakers today. The Williamsport to Pyle Bay Road exists. It's a state-owned road. It's effectively one lane. It is not paved. It goes through a fairly large topography change, and so it's really not a developed corridor, and it's been identified as being potentially of economic value and community-based value to bolster the regional abilities to move goods and people. As far as my perspective goes, I was also interested in QA and QC because I was not the original author, so I did a little bit of background check and review of what was done, mostly to see that industry standards and public documents have been followed and used. Some high-level observations. I just wanted to characterize this so you have them in your mind as we're going through the rest of the slides. Typically, from a noise perspective, we're worried about daytime and nighttime noise. Obviously, nighttime noise is important from a sleep habit perspective. The criticality of that is oftentimes viewed by municipalities, state bodies, governments as more important, so we're very cautious about what that background noise is at that time, and then in the future when we're comparing and contrasting to that for a future development, that's oftentimes a critical component. And in the areas of interest here, basically we're worried about only those occasional boat vehicle traffic as related to planes and helicopters flying over periodically. And then for the Cook Inlet area, obviously when we're bringing boats in, the primary source of industry there is effectively summertime boat transportation through Williamsport to Iliamna Lake. And so a lot of the noise in terms of instantaneous or loud background noise is during that window of time. So it was measured and part of the noise study. The boat traffic in the Cook Inlet area is limited due to lack of development, so most of the transportation from a boat point of view in that area is recreational or related to fishing. Not a lot of other reasons to be cruising through that area, so there's not a lot of information in terms of number of craft, what size of craft, how many current transportation uses go between, say, the Homer Kenai Peninsula and Williamsport area. So we don't have a lot of data on actual usage of that specific corridor. In terms of the mine study area, obviously it's not accessible right now with any roads. It's ATV or maybe snow machine in the wintertime limited. Also helicopters. There's not a lot of data on traffic, how many flyovers there are, what kind of information exists in terms of personnel movement. We do know that the road in the summertime sees about 10 vehicles per day going down the road. So that's the latest data we've seen. Kind of like one of the other speakers today, it's from State of Alaska. We're not 100% clear because the source of data is not certain. It sounds reasonable, but it's not a certain amount of information. So we've had to use that and understand that to our best capabilities. As I mentioned earlier as well, in the study area, there's really no infrastructure for power. All the users of diesel fuel basically have a delivery through either boat traffic through Quijack River up through Iliamna Lake. And at times in the past, in recent past, the river has become not passable, so that's necessitated air deliveries of fuel. That's driven up the cost, and we'll get into the cost in a minute. Obviously, diesel-based power is a expensive mode of power generation. It's also used for the heating of facilities, very expensive. And that's been a challenge, and it's really an economic impact on the residents because we saw through an earlier presentation that demographically the salaries of people are not very high, and when a large percentage of their income is taken by simply heating their houses or having power available, it's a major economic impact. Quickly, I'm going to talk a little bit about noise so everybody kind of understands noise. Just a quick little exercise to give you a little bit of feedback. I'm talking moderately loud right now. So I'm typically in this 50 decibel range. This is a DBA-based scale. You can see on the chart that things like a jet aircraft takeoff is 140 dBA. We typically use 80 dBA as an important reference loudness level because anything above that is typically harmful to somebody's ears. I know that for a fact because if you look up here under 120 at loud rock concerts, I was in a band when I was younger, and I didn't wear ear protection, so I know that it's uncomfortably loud and it does cause damage. So from a noise point of view, when we're talking about a new development, we are interested in what is the background and how far up is the background going to go after the development's in place. So you can see the scale is basically from 0 to 140. DBA is a logarithmic scale. Down at the 0 to 10 range, you can't hear much. This is at typically low frequency levels. You can't really audibly hear it. Actually, sound is measured even lower, and so as a means of trying to characterize this so that it's usable for technical reasons, they've used this decibel A scale almost unilaterally. Decibel A scale is at a specific point in time, so my speaking now versus my speaking now are two different decibel levels, and so it really doesn't help in terms of understanding time progression of noise. So what we typically do is use what's called LEQ. LEQ is an equivalent or average, if you want to take it that way, amount of noise that's carried over a course of time. Typically, LEQ is looked at on an hourly basis. Sometimes we use hourly for a daytime window and then an hourly average or LEQ for nighttime. We also use a couple other measures. Instead of LEQ, we'll use LMAX, LMAX being what is the maximum root mean square noise during a certain window of time. So in that case, it's measured in dBA, and it could be a plane taking off as a maximum point of loudness. We also use what's called L10. L10 is oftentimes the 10% increase above a certain level of threshold. So if I'm talking about a 60 dBA level of interest, an L10 might be 10% of the L10 is the percentage of time that it's over a certain fractal of this scale. So we use that in certain instances. Not so commonly used, I guess, for background measurement in a real rural area, but it's sometimes used. And so some of these data points were recovered in the course of looking at background noise in the transportation corridor. So we'll get into that here. As I mentioned, the mine study area also kind of gravitated forward into the communities of Iliamna, New Halen, Pedro Bay, Non-Dalton. There was a few other communities that were basically surveyed in that corridor. These are all rural communities. There were a total of 15 places measured. Some of these locations were short-term, some were long-term. Typically, what we do is we follow an ANSI standard for measurement on those methods. We use technology that's fairly current and calibrated, so the measurement technology that was applied here was very accurate. The application of the technology was also good in terms of the height where we're measuring, the location we're measuring. We're always looking at receptors, so we're always looking at typically a human receptor. There are more sensitive human receptors in hospitals, schools, certain other activities like that are more sensitive to noise change than others, like industrial users. So whenever we're looking at a new project, we find the closest sensitive receptor and then do some comparative analysis there. So the background data that was collected for the mine area and also the transportation corridor in that vicinity was measured at these critical locations. So an example would be near Iliamna Airport. There were a number of schools in the communities that I mentioned here that were measured. There's a number of hospitals that were measured where the noise recording instrumentation was positioned at those particular areas. I mentioned in terms of what's important from a noise level point of view, so daily pressure level range is what was considered. In these communities across the board, we looked at what is collected, and the range that was offered to us on a daily level was between less than 30 dBA to 63 dBA LEQ. So that means over an hour's time, over a course of a day, the range of noise is typically there. Now, in the communities that we're talking about, we're not looking at a lot of road traffic, we're not looking at a lot of background noise. So The mean, I guess, if you want to characterize it, would be in the 40 to 30 dBA range for daytime. And then at nighttime, we oftentimes found it dropping down below 30. So if you recall on the previous slide, that's really noise that you can't hear. It's a very low background noise, and that's an important characteristic to carry forward on the project. We had times during the day when it rose up to 63 dBA. This is typically when there was some mode of transportation going by, the measurement equipment. Maybe it was some flyovers of airplanes and the like. The maximum short-term level that was measured on the corridor was roughly 100 dBA. It was during an aircraft flyover near the Iliamna Airport. So it does get fairly high. This is a loud number, but it also reflects a very short time frame because a flyover doesn't last for very long. So there was an instantaneous time, but it was roughed out in the averaging process in LEQ. Similarly, on the Cook Inlet side, there was a little bit of data collected manually for Williamsport, the Iliamna, Nisqually Bays, landside. Measurements were taken. There was no measurements taken offshore. There were no measurements taken underwater. These were all above ground noise measurements. In addition to that, because limited data was collected, they also did a cross-section to find out whether it was reasonable that these values that were received are typical. So the report concluded that there was a summer pressure level range typically of, again, less than 30 dBA to 63 dBA LEQ for the port site area. And then in the wintertime, it drops down simply because it's reflecting less traffic that's presently there in the wintertime. And that's in the 28 to 32 dBA range. So these numbers, when we're talking about down to the 30 dBA, is effectively a background wind. So you have wind whipping through particular passes or through areas where that wind is transitioned into a noise pattern, and that's what we're typically seeing in this lower pressure level. And then down at the port area, Cook Inlet, the highest maximum LMAX was 90 dBA. It's typically when haul trucks were moving boats out of the harbor and onto the road. I'm going to move next into power and energy and talk a little bit about that. Important to mention it a little bit earlier is that at the Cook Inlet area, there is no energy system. The closest energy is up north in the Beluga area. There's a power station north up toward Anchorage, northwest of Anchorage, and there's the last transition of a substation there. That's the closest power and energy source that exists on the west side of Cook Inlet. We also have Homer and a background that exists there with Homer Electric Association that exists and is part of the overall rail belt corridor. But it is remote, obviously, and across the inlet, so it's really not immediately adjacent to the study area. So effectively, in the Cook Inlet study area, there's no energy systems. In the mine study area, there's 8 local communities in and near the study area. Of those, there are 6 utilities that serve those 8 communities. There's one larger utility called INN. It services Iliamna, New Haven, and Non-Dalton. That is the utility that does have access to Tasimena Hydro. About 50% to 60%, I think even last year, 75% of its power consumed by the neighbor, or by the residents and commodities that use that power in that community was by hydro, and the rest was by diesel. The rest of these communities are all not connected by any kind of regional transportation path, and they all have their own little utility system, typically diesel engines, and typically with a limited amount of distribution. I mentioned that the rates for petro are going up. We all know that. In 2009, diesel basically was being paid at $5.54 a gallon. Electric rates in that vicinity were about 0.21 cents per kilowatt hour. If you look at it and compare that to national averages or even what you're paying in Anchorage, it's quite a bit more. Part of this is reflected by the transportation requirements to get this particular petrochem to the petro fuels to the need source and the challenges with doing that. And obviously we've been reading in the news lately with places like Nome who have almost were cut off from fuel supply. This is a pandemic problem that exists for these communities, and there certainly needs to be ways to correct that. It comes up every year when I read about this particular statistic in the state of Alaska that almost every energy plan or program plan going forward looks to this and says this needs to be updated and repaired. There has to be movement made. So obviously it was identified and flagged in the Pebble studies that these local communities, A, really don't have any kind of a grid that's available for support, and B, themselves are paying a tremendous penalty for being local and having no buying power for diesel fuel and having a tough time with delivery. So pretty important statistic in consideration going forward. As I mentioned, there's no regional energy system present in that particular area. These six utilities are not interconnected. They're basically their own standalone grid, which in itself adds reliability challenges for its residents. And so I'm sure there's solutions that are probably more regional based that may be coming down the road. A problem that we run into in power development is simply critical base. We have to have a continuous load in order to connect them. And a lot of these communities are cyclic in terms of demand, are not real large, and so transmitting power over larger distances simply isn't a real economic solution. So the communities themselves really don't present a robust system, and there are opportunities potentially down the road for some kind of a solution that integrates them. And leave that point. Again, there's no real economies of scale. There's no simple way to get a break on diesel fuel costs. It's too difficult. The volumes are simply not large enough to get large discounts. And so these communities are really exposed to petroleum cost swings. I'm going to talk a little bit about beyond the study work that was done in the environmental baseline. In 2010, there was a Railbelt Regional Integrated Resource Plan that was written, and it basically was looking at Alaska and particularly the Railbelt communities as a whole. Some important observations in it: there really is no plans for any kind of a power and energy development in the study areas that Pebble has. In other words, there's no plan for a new transmission line, there's no plan for new power generation or anything like that in the two study areas. It also cites the closest generation transmission being in Beluga. It does identify concerns for elevated costs for electricity in local and remote communities, but it really doesn't offer a solution there. It does identify opportunities for study and continuation. Its primary focus was on Kenai Anchorage Fairbanks corridor. So that in itself basically says the focal point for the power development in the rail belt community is simply in this particular corridor. There is no real long-term plan for the study areas. There's another important study, the 2010 AEA Alaska Energy Pathway and 2011 AEA REAP Renewable Energy Atlas, both of which identified that there's opportunities in Southwest Alaska for renewable energy sources. So that's kind of a long-term viable solution. You've heard, I think, in the last 2 days about the wind resource that exists. That's something that should be looked at as well. So there's opportunities to start to divest potentially from this diesel based system. There are a lot of communities in Alaska that are now looking into wind. Some have already developed wind and have identified the values and benefits. So looking at a renewable resource is certainly something in the interest of Alaska. Last thing I'll mention on this topic is gas-based generation. There's new Kenai Peninsula-based storage that's coming into play this year. And so there's a fair amount of natural gas storage that will exist there. Obviously, natural gas is a major topic of discussion right now for this particular region. There's a number of different considerations on that going on. So there is a fair amount of natural gas in the region. And we'll leave it at that. There's opportunities certainly to be looked at in terms of regional power solutions involving natural gas. Again, just to summarize, the mine study area really doesn't have any power grid per se. There's really no diesel systems that make sense in terms of expansion. There's no grid community systems that could be utilized at the present time. A mine study area, once it's developed, is going to need continuous power. We call it baseload power. So the source of power needs to be continuous. It needs to be reliable. So in terms of long-term perspective, that's an important factor in terms of developing the mine area. Obviously, the distance from the transmission grid is very long. The routes that exist right now are very torturous. They're exposed to weather, earthquakes, and things like that. So reliability of a simple transmission solution has to be carefully looked at. Lastly, I'm going to drop into transportation. I think you've seen a lot of these pictures and slides in the past. Obviously, we're talking about a deep port that exists at Homer. There's a pathway that goes across to Williamsport that's an open passage across Cook Inlet. In the Cook Inlet region, we've talked about some of the facilities that exist there being very limited. Williamsport having a dredged area that needs to be repaired on a fairly continuous basis in terms of promoting traffic. And then the roadway that goes from Williamsport over to Pyle Bay being fairly undeveloped, and yet having been on many different studies recently in terms of needing development for economic development of the community. There's also been, in the state of Alaska, two studies. I mentioned the Southwest Alaska Transportation Study, and then there's also an industrial roads option evaluation done. This map shows a number of different port sites that were being considered at the time, and this particular study examined a few of those ports in terms of capabilities for deep water. Then obviously we were looking at the roadway which exists from Williamsport in, and they looked at a couple alternative roadway paths in this particular study. Ultimately, getting over to Pyle Bay, the main courseway is what exists now. There's an alternative going northbound. And then across, in terms of looking at sensitive areas, avoiding some of the areas that were mentioned earlier in terms of cultural impacts, over to the mine site location. And that's included in a study that has been done. The main driver for this was economic development of this particular region, which needs to have some communication and transportation pathway. Obviously, economic growth in this area has some ties to having good transportation modes, and right now there really isn't. Airborne transportation is very expensive and difficult, so this is an area and topical issue for the project itself. So in summary, the region's very small, it's remote, there's inland settlements, but they're very small. They tend not to be interconnected with roadways. There are a few that are, but very limited. The terrain's very rugged. Roadway could enable, this roadway we talked about from Cook Inlet to mine study area could integrate the one road that exists to Pyle Bay right now. So you've got a corridor that exists already. Upgrade of that was cited as an important aspect in this transportation plan. The baseline study that has been done for the EB looked at sustainable roadways in the corridor that we talked about and others in that same vicinity. So roadway has been studied by a number of different parties and continues. And then there are several locations that I mentioned earlier in the last slide in terms of potentials for deep water bay ports in the Cook Inlet area. And that really concludes the topics. Jane mentioned, the environmental baseline for this particular topics, these three topics, were done quite a while ago. They've not been updated. So in a lot of the data recovery was mostly a desktop study. There was some data collected on noise, but that was pretty